So for this evening, it's sorry, about 5 minutes late, and there's lots of questions here. Can I suggest that we just do the meta charts and then go on to the questions and answers?
Yay.
Very good. So, the meta chart. Here we go. But we have to start as usual with the very good.
This is what should be done by one who is skilled in goodness and who knows the path of peace. Let them be able and upright, straightforward and gentle in speech, humble and not conceited, contented and easily satisfied, not busy with duties and frugal in their ways, peaceful and calm and wise and skillful, not proud and demanding in nature. Let them not do the slightest thing that the wise would later reprove, wishing in gladness and in safety, may all beings be happy, whatever living beings there may be, whether they are weak or strong, omitting none, the great or the mighty, medium, short or small, the seen and the unseen, those living near and far away, those born and to be born, may all beings be happy. Let none deceive another or despise any being in any state. Let none through anger or ill will wish harm upon another. As a mother protects with her life her child, her only child, so with a boundless heart should one cherish all living beings, radiating kindness over the entire world, spreading upwards to the skies and downwards to the depths, outwards and unbounded, freed from hatred and ill will, whether standing or walking, seated or lying down, freed from drowsiness, one should suspect this recollection. This is said to be the sublime abiding, by not holding to false views, the pure-hearted one, having clarity of vision, being free from all sense desires, is not born again into this world. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu.
those who haven't seen it yet, this is a little photo of the monk who was found in the cave. It must have been at least 50 or 60 years when they found him. He'd already been dead. No one knows who he was. Perfect posture. So this is what will happen to me if I don't get my baked beans in the morning. So you can have a look at it later on. See you after that. Anyway, let's now see Q&A.
So here we go. What are the differences between oneness of mind and first jhana? He said absence of thought. In my experience is correct. Oneness of thought is very energetic and blissful too. It's oneness of mind. A mind doesn't have to have thinking. You can have the mind without thought. It's so easy, and I will just demonstrate how easy it is. Because as I am speaking, you'll find some spaces between my words. In the same way, there are spaces between your thoughts. You're aware, but you're not thinking. So, thinking is just giving things a name, describing them, and just listening is like not talking back to the life, not talking back to the world, but listening to the world, not describing it, not trying to capture it, like you capture a photograph, you capture somebody on a photograph, but it's just knowing. So, the oneness of mind, the ekagata, it's not an ordinary oneness of mind, it's a very powerful mind. And of course, from oneness, you go even further to nonness. Unfortunately, the nun has vanished, which is very profound. What are the signs of being on the path of stream winning? Not asking questions about are you on the path of stream winning, because once a person is a stream winner, they've gone beyond doubt. So if you wonder, am I a stream winner or not, that means you've got doubt, that means you're not. No, it's just sometimes it's difficult to know if you are on the path or if you are a stream winner. But you can certainly know someone who's not. That's like someone who's enlightened. You know, I remember this monk who thought he was enlightened, and it took his head monk mixing up two saucepans of curry to show him he wasn't. So sometimes it's easy to know we aren't, but to know that you are is always very, very difficult. And it doesn't really matter, because as long as you are practicing, making progress, even as a stream winner, you've still got more to do. So just keep practicing the Eightfold Path, and keep practicing the Eightfold Path, and keep practicing the Eightfold Path. And that's all you ever do anyway. Where you are on that path, it's not so important as long as you keep practicing. Is it true that all Buddhas get enlightened in the same place? Yes, they get enlightened in their body and mind. That's where they get enlightened. In here. Who was the first astronaut? Who was it? The first person in space? No, he was only the first person on the moon. Come on, who's the first person in space? Sorry? No, he was the first person in the modern age in space. Well, actually, very close. The first was this monk called Rohitasa. Yeah, because he was this little, I don't even know if he was a Buddhist. Well, he might have been a Buddhist, but I think before the present Buddha. And he developed this amazing ability to levitate. But not just to levitate, to really go through it. To actually to go into space. And he said he went so far into space where the moon and the sun shine not. In other words, you know, below the, beyond the solar system, or far enough away that there was very little light. And he kept going because he wanted to find where the universe ends. And so he went and went and went, looking for the end of the universe. You know what happened? He died. He died on the way, never found the end of the universe. And so when he got reborn, as in the Deva realms, he went to ask the lower Deva realms, where does this universe end without remainder? And the lower Deva realms said, oh, we don't know, but there's other Devas above us. I think he asked the Buddhas, the earthbound Devas. And then said, well, we've got these other Devas, like the four great kings. Go and ask them. So he went to that level of Deva realm and said, you know where the earth, the universe ends without remainder? No, we don't know, but above us, there's the realm of the 33, the Tawatingsa. So ask them, they'll probably know. So he went to the Tawatingsa realm. So where does the world end without remainder? Oh, beats us, we don't know. But there's another realm, the Tusita gods. Try them. So he went to the Tusita gods. Have you ever gone through the government bureaucracy? And always you ask, and you always get sort of palmed off as, oh, it's not our department, it's somebody else. That's what it was like. So he went up the chain of command, so to speak, you know, the different devas. After the Tusita realm, it was the Nimanavati realm. The Nimanavati realm. So we don't know. Go and try the next one up, the Paranimitta Vasavati realm. And so they try that. Nope, we don't know. Go up to the Brahma realm. And they went up to the Brahma realm, and there they met they called the people the retinue of Brahma. They said, well, we don't know, but Brahma, you know, the great God, he will certainly know. Well, where is he? Something we don't know. But every now and again, they said, there's this huge light, and he peers out of the light. Nimittas. Because in that realm, the Brahma realm, it's a sign that sort of that being goes into the jhanas and then sometimes emerges out of them, in and out. And said, and so he waited a while, and then the Brahma sort of emerged out of the nimitta. And so this Rohitasa sort of asked, where does the universe end without remainder? And the Brahma God said, I am the firstborn, I am the all-powerful, the creator, blah, blah, blah. He said, yeah, I know, but that's not what I asked you. Where does the universe? I am, and he said that again, and the third time. I said, but that's not why I asked you. And that's when the Brahma took this monk aside and said, looked around and said, look, don't embarrass me, I don't know. And you know, people think I know everything. And anyway, you're a very stupid monk, he said. You should have gone to your teacher, the Buddha. He will know where the universe ends without remainder. And so he went to see the Buddha, told his story, and he said, yeah, you are a stupid monk. The universe ends in this fathom-long body and mind. That's where the beginning and the end of the universe can be found. So in here. That's where you find the beginnings and ending of things, in your own body and mind. And that's where the Buddha gets enlightened. Were you expecting to say he gets enlightened in Bodh Gaya? Or in India? What's special about India anyway? What's special about Bodhinyana Monastery, Jhana Grove, and Dharamsala? Why have these places really grown, while other places in Australia are not so successful? You know why? It is because thousands of years ago, as the continental drift, the idea of tectonic plates, there was this continent called Gondwana land, and it split, and on that split, India separated from Australia, not from Sydney, but from West Australia here. If you actually look at West Australia and look at India, you almost like fit in those two continents. And in fact, the geology of this area is very similar to the geology of East India. In fact, people accept that this part of Australia was connected to India many hundreds of thousands of years ago, probably in the time of previous Buddhas. So, maybe in the past, previous Buddhas walked on this land on which you are now meditating on. That's why it's powerful. Ooh. They never walked in Sydney or Melbourne, that's too far away. But okay, it's exaggerating things a little bit, but this actually land was actually part of India. Many hundreds of thousands of years ago. So who knows? Ooh. All Buddhas get enlightened in their body and mind. If Hindus and Catholics, saints, ascetics, could have a similar deep meditation like jhana, even the first jhana, how is it different from the jhana the Buddha taught? One of the reasons I thought this might happen is to actually to get into those deep meditations, you have to let go. So how could some of these saints, Christian saints, get that? And one of the reasons is because they let go, and just let God take over. They totally surrendered. They really did let go. That belief in an ultimate being was something which allowed them to let go. And they weren't worried about what would happen because, God will take care of that. So that is one of the reasons why at that time it seemed to be easier. They just really totally gave themselves up to an ultimate. But that was in sort of the old days. I haven't seen much of that in recent times. But yes, they can do that sometimes and get into deep meditations like that because of selflessness. Remember that great saying from the Visuddhimagga, the path is, but no traveller on it is seen. Nibbana is, but not the person who enters it. It's all just saying about some non-self. If you try and do something, you'll mess it up. But if you just let go, relax, abandon your sense of self and control and doing stuff, then the path is very easy. So you can see that sometimes people who do believe in a sort of an ultimate being, just it's easier for them to let go. But up to a point. But still, then they merge with the ultimate, they can't go any further, they can't disappear totally. Anyway, next question. Are the talks on meditation downloaded to listen on the internet? Thank you, Ajahn Brahm. They are downloaded in your mind bank. And when they're important, they will come up for you. Just like that story of the mango trees. And the only way to get the mango to fall is to sit perfectly still underneath it. Now, there's no recordings of that at the time. And I remember listening to it and just totally thinking it was rubbish and doesn't make any sense to me. But then it was recorded somewhere in my mind. And when it was really useful, it really came up. It is a very strange phenomenon, but very deep teachings, which you think you don't understand, they are recorded. They're recorded in there, and sometimes when they're needed, up they come. And it's happened so many times, I think, when did that one come from? And I just investigated, explore it. That's what Ajahn Chah said years ago. And I haven't really thought of it since. So amazing, it's called brainwashing. And I freely admit, for the last 8 days, I've been brainwashing you. But in a good way, to be happy and content and peaceful. So it's nothing sort of insidious or dangerous. I just encourage you to let go. Of course they are downloaded as well on the internet somewhere. And that's right, I think the Jhana Grove, I think the caretakers have downloaded all of this stuff. Because that's why Christina was saying, or what about some of these bad jokes or some of the stuff I said? And, you know, should they really be edited out? There's too much to edit out. There's so much bad jokes and stuff. That is whatever. And if somebody complains, they can't sue me, so I've got no money. And if they decide to put me in jail instead, yes, retreat. If I go in jail, I've already told you that in jails in Australia, they're much more comfortable than this monastery. A good example of that was, there was this Thai monk, Chao Khun Thep Sitimuni. And I remember just reading a little bit of his biography, that he was a really good monk. He was a meditator, but very good Pali scholar and a good administrator. So, you know, he was given all these jobs. He became like an administrator as well as a very, very good monk. And then eventually he became like the second to the Sangharaja of Thailand. And so he was next in line to be, you know, this really important role, the leader of the Sangha. And then number three, the one underneath him, was really jealous. Now, there are some monks who just do it for the power, prestige and stuff like that, you know, on ego trips. So number three monk sort of decided, my goodness, when the Sangharaja dies, the head of the Sangha there, you know, number two will take over, I'll never get a chance. So how can I get rid of number two? So what he did, he recorded many of that monk's talks on the old cassette tapes, spliced them, edited them, put them all together, and to suggest that he was a communist. And the days where, you know, that communism in Asia was regarded as a big threat. And so that the number three monk said, look, this monk is teaching communism. It's against the law in Thailand. So they had a case against him, and he was convicted of being a communist. So they put him in jail for 2 or 3 years. And for monk, when you go to jail, you have to take off your brown robes and usually wear white. And he kept all his precepts, though. He just eat in the morning and just obviously have no money. And he was, he said it was one of the best times of his life. It was like a 2-3 year retreat. He didn't have any jobs. He didn't have any interviews or give any talks. So many problems. He was in jail by himself for 2 or 3 years. He says, a wonderful, peaceful time. And then what happened after 2.5 or 3 years, of course, the Sangharaja died and number three monk was promoted to be the head monk. And then they had this strange occurrence. The Sangharaja, you know, the one who was responsible for putting this guy in jail, this monk in jail, the Sangharaja was going either to or from the Don Mueang airport, you know, with the police motorcade, because, you know, they always look after the Sangharaja, is given all sorts of privileges and always travels with police escort. And he was traveling in a middle car, and then a car going in the opposite direction lost control and went over the median strip and slammed into the car carrying the Sangharaja. And the only person hurt was that Sangharaja. Everyone else was fine. Even the driver of the car, which lost control, was fine. But the Sangharaja was killed instantly. I mean, that was such a weird accident. It was so strange that people thought in Thailand, this must be some karma. This must be really weird. How come that happened? And that one monk, Sangharaja, was killed by that car. So they started investigating. What did he do wrong to have this happen? And they reviewed that case. And we saw just how that Chao Khun Thep Sitimuni had been set up. And so they released him from jail. He was exonerated, pardoned. It was a false conviction. But, you know, it was too late to be Sangharaja of Thailand. He says, oh, no, peaceful, I just carry on being an abbot in my monastery, just meditate. And he had no anger or ill will. He said it was a wonderful thing. You know, he escaped from that big authority and the burden of being a Sangharaja. He escaped just by a tiny amount You know, and so he didn't have to worry about all that problems in Thailand. So, and his attitude was so beautiful. He was put in jail and he made the best of it. And he said it was a wonderful time. So that's, I always remember that. So, you know, if I say something on those talks and somebody sues me, then I can go to jail and it's a wonderful time in there. Really relaxed, you get baked beans every morning. Don't have to travel. Just relax. If I want to go on a really silent retreat, all you need to do is just to very slightly punch one of the prison officers, you get 3 months solitary. A real retreat. And I'm sure the beds in jail are much softer than... You saw my cave today. You saw my bed in there. You know, a jail cell is much more comfortable than that. Anyway, dear Arjun, what is enlightenment? How to define the state of enlightenment? Thank you. When I was at school, we had scholarships all the way. So we went to a pretty good high school. And at that high school, the other alumni at the time, no, actually just a little bit after, because it was like in West London, in Hammersmith, really close to the BBC. So Hugh Grant, he went there. You know, the film. And it's also, I forget what his name is now, but he was apparently one of the stars in Harry Potter, the one who played, he was not really a bad guy, Professor Snape? Is that right, Snape? Yes. So, and all these actors went to the school I was in, because it was, you know, close to the BBC, and so they got lots of breaks to actually to go, be acting. That's where I get my dramatic skill from. No. So anyway, I remember asking, they had a chaplain there, an Anglican chaplain, and I asked him one day, well, what is God? Can you please describe it? He says, I'm interested, I just, let me know. And he said, oh, it's ineffable, it's, you know, you can't really, it's all over the place. It's the A to Z, it's the beginning and ending of all things, it's beyond words. And he said that, the ground of all being, he said. It didn't make any sense to me, the ground of all being. I know what the ground is, I know what being is, but you know, what are you talking about? And so it was one of the reasons they couldn't really give a very good description to me. A really one which, you know, everyone can really understand. And later on, when I went to see Buddhist monks, I asked the Buddhist monk, well, you know, what is enlightenment? They said, it's beyond words. It's the beginning and end of all things. It's the ground of all being. It's ineffable. And I said, I've heard that somewhere before. But then, later on, you know, you came across some of these forest teachers, and they really had it together. And they could describe these things in a way which everyone could understand. So this is the definition, the explanation of what enlightenment is, which even kids can understand at school. So, what is it? It is the story of the five children playing the wishing game. I think it's in Mindfulness, Bliss and Beyond, the Happiness Through Meditation book. So, five children playing the wishing game. The wishing game goes like this. Every child has a wish, and the one who comes up with the best wish wins the game. So the first kid, you have a wish, what would you wish? And he thought for a few moments and said, a new video computer game. A new Nintendo. Is that right, Nintendo? Is that still doing stuff? An Xbox, does that make sense? I don't know, I've never played video games. So anyway, a new video game, whatever I want. Very good. So then they asked the second kid, the girl. She had a bit more time to think and so got a much better wish. If I just ask for a video game, that's only one video game, that's not very good. So I will ask for a video game shop. I own it. That way I can get a new video game whenever I want one and, you know, until I get really old. You know, sometimes people think that, oh, kids playing video games, it's not very good. But I shouldn't say this, especially don't tell your children this, but there was this one kid, he was a friend of one of the monks, and he was playing video games all day, not doing well at school. was playing video games. He'd really got scolded by his mum. So then he decided he created his own video game. It really took off. He made a few million dollars. And then his mother and father never complained anymore. Forget about your grades. He was a multimillionaire. Don't tell your kids that, because it's a mummy. Otherwise they won't go to school. But anyway, so the second kid got a video game shop. And the third kid had longer to think and said, if I had a wish, you know, having a video game shop, still my mum and dad won't let me play. I'd always have to go to school. So he said, if I had a wish, I'd wish for, say, $10 billion US. With $10 billion US, I will buy my own video game shop, and the next, I'll buy my own school. And if I buy my own school, if I'm the one who can hire and fire the teachers, no teacher will dare tell my mum that I'm not doing my homework. They will always give me really good grades. Otherwise, I sack them all. So, when I graduate from my own school, then I'll buy my own university, like Mr. Trump did, Trump University. And if I own a university, I'll be able to give myself honorary degrees without doing any work. And all the time I can play video games. And whenever I find out something else I want, I can always buy that. Because with $10 billion, you know, how can you spend $10 million unless, this is one thing which will be edited out of the tape, unless you're the Prime Minister of Malaysia or is what? That gets edited. All you people can't spend that amount of money. That $10 billion US wish. Beat that. There's two kids left. And the fourth kid, this girl, she was really smart. So I can beat that, easy. And don't say $20 billion US or $30 billion, because $10 billion is as much money as you can spend. So, the fourth kid said, if I had a wish, I would wish for three wishes. That's a wish. For my first wish, I'll have the video game shop. Second wish, I'll have the $10 billion US. For my third wish, I'll have three more wishes. That way I can go on forever. Beat that. And that was actually a very smart wish. Infinity of wishes granted. So, the fifth kid. The fifth kid would win the wishing game. That fifth kid would manage to find a wish which everybody agreed was superior. And the fifth kid said, and have a think for it. If you haven't know the answer to this, have a think. What could be better than an infinity of wishes granted? And I know you know this, so be quiet, come on. Don't spoil my fun. So the fifth kid said, I wish I was so content I never needed any wishes ever again. So content I never needed any wishes. That is the Buddha talking about enlightenment. So content you don't need anything, which is much superior than having every wish granted, which is the joy of power. You're in power so you can get whatever you want, which is more desirable for some than having wealth. I always wonder why it is that somebody like a Donald Trump would want to be President of the United States. He's got all the money he wants. But he wants power to have wishes granted. But even more superior than that is to be so content you don't want any wishes. That's enlightenment. The end of wanting. And that's a very beautiful little answer, similarly. Ajahn, what are the signs of being on the path of stream winning? That's another one. What are the signs of being on the path of stream winning? Exactly the same words. Just like that story I said about those two kids. You know, two twins. And they had to do a homework. And when they handed it in, it was on my dog. And when they handed it in, an essay on their dog, it was word for word the same. And so the teacher said, "You've been cheating." "No, we haven't been cheating," said the two children. "Well, how come the essay is word for word the same?" You know what another two kids said? "Well, it's the same dog." What do you expect? So it's two sides, but it's actually different handwriting. Two people have been cheating. Do you encourage us to practice as super meditation? Meditating on the 31 parts of the body or rotting corpse to get rid of attachment to the body. People that I've known who do a super meditation, they don't actually get rid of attachment to the body. They just get weird and disgusting to the body. It's just the body that's all. So you just... a super goes a little bit too far. Sometimes people just focus on so much negativity towards the body. So instead, it's just the body. Much better just, you know, the body decays, fine. It's made up of all sorts of stuff, fine. But the best thing is it's just always aching and never comfortable, always hungry and thirsty, a bad knee, a bad back, a bad bottom, a bad toe. There's always something going on in the body. That's much more like a super, the fact that the body is never comfortable, will never satisfy you, without going to the repulsiveness of the body. Of course, you know, sometimes you can practice a super if you want to, especially if you're really attached to somebody. Because that was the story of Ajahn Chah. You know, because actually, I was there in the back of a car when this happened. There was a driver taking it from the monastery to... train station, no, not airport. Well, there was an airport there, but there's no public flights. And he was in the driver, Ajahn Chah in the front seat, passenger seat, and there's three Western monks in the back. And I was one of them. The other monk was a really good translator. And the third monk, I still remember his name, Gary, New Mexico, but he did his degree over in LA. And he actually knew, what was his name, that film actor who became a director afterwards, Clint Eastwood. Because Clint Eastwood went to the same college, and they have these fraternities, you know, fraternities, Alpha, Beta, Gamma or something. And every sort of boy has to join a fraternity, every girl joins a sorority. And that becomes, you know, just almost like your club. And so his fraternity was the same as the fraternity where Clint Eastwood went. But Clint Eastwood had already left and was starting his career in Hollywood as an actor. And sort of Clint came one evening and said into the fraternity, "Any of you got a tuxedo? I'm having a party tonight and need some bodyguards." Or, you know, some ushers. And so this guy, his name was Gary, said, "Yeah, I've got tux." He was a big guy. "So yeah, I'll volunteer for tonight." And so, you know, he went to the big match in Beverly Hills and was parking people's cars and being a sort of a little bodyguard. And he said one of the cars, some budding film actress, had a fur mobile. The whole car was upholstered in animal fur. Yeah, but anyway, that was supposed to be really chic in those days. But anyway, all these famous film actresses and stuff, and he was driving their cars and looking after them. And then, I think, you know, he was just hanging around like a bit of a bodyguard. And then somebody said, "There's somebody in the cloakroom." So he went in there, and somebody was actually stealing stuff from the people's pockets. And so, you know, he got hold of him, and he just took him out from the mansion. But just as he was pushing him out, he tripped. And so, because he tripped, he actually looked like he was throwing the guy quite violently out of the mansion. And it was just what tough guys should do. And it was totally accidental, but it was this one moment of glory. All these famous film actresses were coming up to him and said, "That was wonderful. oh, you're such a man. Oh, and you know, all this famous people, he thought, wow, oh, this is really good. It was totally an accident, but he took the praise anyway. And even sort of Clint Eastwood, wow, you know, not even I could do that. But anyway, going back to the story. that he was in the back of the car, and Ajahn Chah turned around. And through the translator, he said, you are thinking of your girlfriend back in L.A. And he's only a novice, he's only just become a monk. And this poor monk, busted by Ajahn Chah in public. And you know, you can see his face drop. Because it was true. You know, you better be very careful what you're thinking. In front of monks like Ajahn Chah. And so, whew. So yeah, and Ajahn Chah is such a compassionate, kind monk. He said, I think we can help you there so you don't have to, you know, suffer so much. And he said to him, just next time you write to your girlfriend, just ask her, you know, because you know, sometimes we miss each other. He said, ask her to send something of hers to you so that when you miss her, you can pick, you know, take it out and remind you of her so you don't feel so lonely and sort of so heartbroken that she's on the other side of the world and you're in Thailand. He said, you can do that? That's not against the rules. I said, oh yeah, you can do that. And when Ajahn Chah starts playing around like that, you know that something good and great's going to happen. Oh yeah, you can do that. And he said, oh, what should I ask for? Like a lock of her hair? You know, a bit of a dress with a scent on? He said, no, not that. He said, ask her to send a little bottle of her shit. So when you miss her, you can open up the cock. Oh, that's my girlfriend back in L.A. Isn't it the case you love everything about you, my darling? That was so gross. But so funny. No, that's Ajahn Chah. You know, that should have been edited out, but no, this is funny. And if you're a nun, think of your boyfriend somewhere, you do the same. Dear darling, can you please send me some of your feces? Anyway, let's not go there anymore. I'm happy to be Buddhist. What was that coming out? Rotting corpse. Yeah, it didn't work. He just woke. I'm happy to be Buddhist and more than happy to share my knowledge to those who wish to listen. However, I feel Buddhism is a very precarious situation, which is nothing more than rites and rituals, superstition, magic culture, or people just put in to fill in the blank for religion. People claiming to be Buddhists often mix it with other forms of worship, such as Taoism, Hinduism, and animism. And worse, there are so many traditions in Buddhism, Theravada, Mahayana, Vajrayana, with very different interpretations of what is Buddhism. A monk told me this, Guan Yin and Amitabha is not Buddhism. My father chanted the Mahayana sutras in Chinese at home, even among party Buddhism. There are different views and doctrines too. Ajahn Brahm, how should we restore the real Buddhism? Is real Buddhism chanting, or is it chanting not Buddhism? Isn't real Buddhism being kind and respectful? So if your father wants to chant Kuan Yin Buddhism, and you say, that's not real Buddhism, you're not a Buddhist, saying things like that. It just, your father gets peace and happiness out of it. Wonderful. It doesn't do any harm. So, great. So, you mix it with other forms of worship, such as Taoism, Hinduism, or animism. If it works, Hinduism, yoga. Do you do yoga exercises? Do some stretching? Is that mixing up things? So basically, if it's useful, if it works, why not? So what is actually Buddhism? It's not sort of a dogma, more like the way that you look at life and the kindness and the way that you can make peace, be kind, be gentle. And sometimes you ask, making peace, being kind, being gentle, is that unique to Theravada or Mahayana or Vajrayana? Another example is, I was giving a conference on on chaplaincy here in Australia, at the local university, University of Western Australia. And so they wanted me to present on Buddhism and Christianity. And I was presenting with the abbot of the Benedictine monastery, Abbot Placid. And I've known him a long time. I go around to his monastery, in a really old monastery, he's been to our monastery. If you go to the dining room of Bodhinyana, you see a big picture of the Benedictine monks and the Theravada monks in the bell house. So anyway, one day we were walking around his monastery, which was really old, about 300 years old, 250 years old. And I said, are there any ghosts, you know, in this monastery? Because I love ghosts, you know I like ghosts. And then he said, no, in the Catholic religion we don't believe in ghosts. And you know what I said next? What about the Holy Ghost then? Ha ha, I caught you. So we would tease one another and crack jokes together. It was really good fun. Fortunately, he passed away. But I was co-presenting with him. And then this Australian guy, he was a very top intellectual, Father Frank Brennan. You know, he was always on his government committees. He was a Jesuit, a really sharp mind. So you can't crack jokes to a person like that. So when he asked me a question, which was a really important question, what's the Buddhist concept of God? That was the question he asked me. And to say that Buddhism don't believe in a God or blah, 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 that doesn't get you anywhere. That's what most people would say as Buddhists. So what I said, well, look, this is my a really good friend, this Catholic abbot, Benedictine. And I said that he's always been telling me something. He said one of his core beliefs, he was, everyone is searching for God. He said, now, I'm not going to argue with that. I'm going to ask to try and investigate it, explore it. What does that mean? This is the whole idea of exploring. I said, what do Buddhists search for? They're searching for peace. For loving kindness. The ability to be loved. And to love yourself and to love others. Freedom. Happiness. Truth. You can add a few more things to that. Respect is an important one. You want to be respected. So, if that's what Buddhists are searching for, and everyone is searching for God, that's what God means. Peace, respect, truth, the ability and the privilege to love and be loved, and receive love, to be peaceful, to find your own truth in whatever words you have. So, that's what God is. And I got a very nice accolade. So I was like, ah, yeah, that's a good answer. I remember that. And that was from a very powerful intellectual Jesuit. So that's an answer which creates bridges, not walls, which stops people fighting one another. Because, well, what would you want in life? Those things. So, that's why real Buddhism came to be Buddhist, often mixing with other types of worship, such as Taoism, Hindu, or animism. I just respect people, that's where they're at. As long as they're kind. They're searching for the truth. They may not be there yet. They may not be the university professor of Buddhism, but they're good, kind people. So basically, give them a break. As long as it's not harming or hurting others. And superstition is good. I love superstitions. For example, I was at my mother's place once, and visiting her. We always look after our parents. And she was making my lunch, so we always look after our tummy too. So when somebody rang the doorbell, I said, Mom, I will answer that. You know, you do the important business, my lunch. When you only eat once a day, it's really important. So I answered the door, and this was in London. And they had a person, it's actually from the Roma community, you know, they call them gypsies over in England. And, you know, they are itinerant people, they, you know, going from place to place. And they were making just little bits of money here and there by selling gypsy trinkets. No, not really valuable things. And so when I answered her, I said, do you want to buy a gypsy charm, a trinket? You know, just, you know, a small little thing. I said, no, thank you. I was very polite. And then she looked at me and said, if you don't buy this, I'll put a gypsy curse on you. That was a marketing campaign. She was going to curse me if I didn't buy it. And I thought, that's really just going too far. So I stood up, had my robe on, and said, you know who I am? I am a Buddhist monk of many years training. My curses are much more powerful than your ones. And she ran away. You know, to this day I always regret it, not really, but as part of me regrets it. I really scared her and she ran away. So sometimes superstitions can be helpful. You don't overdo them. Anyway, the Buddha recommends lay people to go to heavens after they die, or that they should strive for stages of enlightenment, eventually liberated from rebirth. Which is a better description of the verb or noun, nibbana? The Buddha attained nibbana, or the Buddha nibbana'd? I like nibbana'd. Sounds better. If upeka is the last factor of the seven factors of enlightenment, that the mind is perfectly still and unmoving in this stage of equanimity, does this mean that the path the Buddha is to develop upeka as the final goal? Is jhana the same as the samadhi factor of enlightenment, the number six in the seven factors of enlightenment? Second question, yeah, jhanas are the samadhi factor of enlightenment, number six of the seven factors of enlightenment. It is jhana again. And the equanimity, it's not just, you can't stay in jhana forever. So you come out of jhana, but that gives this beautiful equanimity. Nothing phases you. Whether you have rotten fish curry or some other curry, and some other people, you know, show their greed and just mix it all up, and hypocrisy, mix it all up before they give you yours. Upeka means, oh yeah, okay, it's all the same, never mind. So it's the upeka is the ability not to be upset. You know, by other people's behaviour. It's just people are people. They're all learning. So, eventually they'll get there. But that's the upeka of the last factors, seven factors of enlightenment. It doesn't mean you just sit there and just watch people being killed, or you watch a little kid, you know, about to cross the road in front of a lorry. You know, upeka means, oh, it's his karma, let him be squashed. Well, you can't do things like that. You pay, because if you can do something out of kindness, you do it. Devadatta does not have right view. He has great craving for power, has great ego. With all his wanting, how is he able to attain jhanas? Is it that whether one will get jhanas one day depends on our conditions? Sometimes you can let go. Sometimes it just you just press the letting go button. The rest of the time you may have lots of craving. But, you know, somehow or other he managed to do the letting go button and get the jhana and get some psychic powers. But also remember, he'd been practicing a long time over many years, many lifetimes. You said, good meditation is nothing doing. My fear it should be just sitting still with eyes closed, but Atlan says we have to watch the breath without missing one. That I feel is something doing. Yeah, it is something doing. You're correct there. This is the very beginning. You know, you can actually watch. And it's not what you do either, it's just what happens. You're just sitting there. And eventually just the breath is there and you are watching the whole breath. It's not something you decide to do. It's something which happens. I really feel I'm hopeless. Excellent. The ones which are not hoping. Hoping is about the future. You know, you hope this might happen, you hope this doesn't happen. If you're really without hope, then that means you're in the present moment. You have got what it takes. I miss plenty of breath and only watch a few breaths. Help! Easy. So you don't need to watch all the breaths. Only just, even you don't need to even just breathe. Make sure that you just breathe in now. keep doing that for the rest of your life and then breathe out, and that's all you need to do. And then you live a long life. Is chanting the same as praying? If there is no God in Buddhism, how does a chant work its magical powers? I know that Buddhist monks are great in their chanting to get rid of ghosts. I remember the chief priest, Venerable K.C. Dharmananda. And I gave this talk once, and I was at Brickfields Temple in Kuala Lumpur, just outside of KL, but anyway, you know what I'm talking about. And, you know, I would go there to give a talk. He said, well, what subject do you want to give a talk on? Know what people like. Again, not Four Noble Truths or Eightfold Path. Ghosts. So my talk was on ghosts. And the hall was packed. You never saw so many people in that hall. And people were looking through the window, standing outside. And that was just the human beings, not counting the ghosts. Because people like, you know, to have hear themselves being talked about. You know, if they were talking about you, you'd always want to listen. What are they saying about me? That's a wonderful, memorable evening. And anyway, he told a story that, you know, close by, that there was a house had a ghost in it. So they tried all the different religions to try and get rid of it, and then they called him in. And it made the Buddhists have got a very good reputation as ghostbusters. Honestly, you know, we're really good at that. I'll tell you why in a minute. But for him, he did the chanting, and the ghost actually left the house. It worked. But that was only the start of the problem, because the ghost just went next door. And so he had to chant in every house in the street. It was a big street. Chant in every house in the street to make sure the ghost didn't just go back next door, but actually left the neighbourhood. The ghosts are very tricky. But one of the reasons why we're very good at getting rid of ghosts is because you've heard the chanting. You know, it's any self-respecting ghost, this is terrible! Can't you monks chant in key or something nice and melodious? You know, like the Gregorian chanting of those Benedictine monks, it's really beautiful. You know, they can't do it. Any ghost would like to hang out and hear more of that. They're not going to go. So you know, give me some more chanting. It's very beautiful chanting. And even the Hindu, it's very beautiful chanting. But the Buddhist chanting, it's always usually in a monotone. You know, it is peaceful, Bhagavan. Don't say, it is peaceful. And there's no sort of, you know, melody to it or something. And so no wonder the ghosts hate the Buddhist chanting. It's just really sort of nasty on the ears. And so that's why they go. So that's why the Buddhists, especially those who are not very good at chanting, they're the ones to invite to your house, because ghosts go straight away. And the power, how does it work its magical power? It's not an intermediary with a divine being. It's just using your own power. Getting into people's minds. And actually energizing them. Giving them a boost of power. So it's, you know, and it's, that's why you can do the same prayer or the same chant, but it depends on the monk or nun it comes from, whether it really has power. How does reincarnation explain the evolution of humans from apes? Why is there a population explosion? Where do these people reincarnate from? It's pretty obvious. As the human population grows, the population of gorillas disappears. So many gorillas are now human beings, mostly Hell's Angels and bikies. You look at those, you know, some of those people you see, those professional wrestlers, you know, in those cage fights, and they were gorillas in the past life, obviously. Look at them. Usain Bolt is probably like a panther or something. He can run really fast. Makes sense to me. So, no, seriously, the animal realm has almost disappeared. There's so many species. You know, there's millions of them. And of course, now there's no place for them anymore. So many of them have been reborn as human beings. And don't ever think that human beings are so superior. It was the scientist Linnaeus was the person who decided to classify all animals into their species. And in order to classify, you know, people like classifying things, put them in boxes, they had to have a method, a methodology which he had to stick to, so he could, you know, take an animal and from what it looked like or from what it did, could put it into this species or that species. And he used that methodology, you know, so strictly without sort of altering it for all beings until he came to the final three beings, gorillas, chimpanzees, and human beings. And as far as his methodology, his science, they're all the same species. One and the same species. But he realized if he published that, you know, Europe at that time would not allow it. They'd think it was crazy to put human beings on the same level as gorillas and chimpanzees. Would not be acceptable. So you know what he did? He broke his own rules and he separated gorillas and chimpanzees, primates and Homo sapiens, even though that people know that there's hardly any difference. So if you want to know the differences and get really challenged, people years ago, they told me about, and you can see it on YouTube, a grey African parrot. What's it called? Alex. A-L-E-X. Alex the parrot. And it's worthwhile, just when you get home, Google Alex the parrot and see a video of him. Grey African parrots live a long age, 50, 60 years. And so this speech therapist decided as an experiment to see if a parrot could learn English, using the same methods that we've developed to teach children with speech difficulties and learning difficulties. And they were wildly successful. This parrot can speak English and can have a conversation. And this is not a Hollywood dream world special effects. This is real. And it's really freaky when you see Alex the parrot, who passed away now, but Alex the parrot have a conversation with people. A simple conversation and speaking. And what really convinced me on one video of Alex the Parrot was, you know, being taught, you know, what's this? And he said, it's a triangle, it's a square, it's red, it's yellow. And Alex turned around and said, I'm bored, can I go now? It was a parrot with attitude. And it shows you this intelligence. We all know that Coco the gorilla in New York Zoo was taught sign language. And, you know, it could communicate. And was sometimes not realizing that he was being observed. Coco the gorilla was actually talking to himself. You know, with the sign language. And it was just showing this sort of thing, how we sometimes don't recognize the huge intelligence in animals, and we think that we are so superior. In the suttas, there is no reference of vipassana was taught by the vipassana movement, which is Burmese, rather than Buddhist. Is it possible to say the term vipassana was used by the Buddha in the suttas as the quality of the mind to evaluate? It's not so much the quality of the mind to evaluate, but the quality of the mind to explore and to see deeply into things. Is chanting... Oh, same as praying, I did that one. The evolution. The vapes. Ajahn Brahm, if one decides to go forth into the monkhood, what are the prerequisites? You've got to... If it's a monkhood, you have to be a man and you have to be breathing. And you have to be a good person. So what about his existing wealth, family ties and such? For the wealth is, you know, sometimes, give all your money to the monastery or the temple. And that's called stripping your assets before kicking you out. You can't do things like that, strip people's assets. So they're coming really wealthy and they're doing everything to the temple. Thank you very much, now out. So what we actually do, if people have got some worldly wealth, we tell them to, what's the word, liquidate it. So it's one account, put it in the bank. And say, for example, my lay name before was Peter Betts. So it's in the account of Peter Betts. And I can't touch it. I'm now Ajahn Brahm. So I can't sort of touch that money. It belongs to Peter Betts. And so it's there just in case a person needs to disrobe afterwards. All sorts of reasons. So you're only in the monastery as a monk because you like being a monk. Not because, you know, you'll be too poor if you disrobe. So, it's there in case you need it, but you can't touch it, you can't use it. And usually I say for the monks here and the nuns, after 4 or 5 years, then you just dispose of it. Give it away somewhere, but you don't give it to the temple in which you live. Otherwise, it's, you know, it's like just spending it on yourself. So, for example, if there's a monk here who ordains, and that he has some money after 4 or 5 years, okay, now you're going to be a monk. They usually know then they're going to be a monk for life. So give it to somewhere else, you know, some other place, but don't give it to Bodhinyana Monastery here, because otherwise it's like a bit of a conflict of interest. It also means if a person does decide, for one reason or another, they're not cut out for this life, then they have, you know, a little fund ready for them, so they're not destitute when they leave the monastery. So that's how it works. So, that's what we do with wealth. Family ties. The family ties, you always keep them. And even one of these monks, Venerable Veeradhammo, his name was, I think I mentioned that he went to, did I mention it? His mother was very sick in Canada. She was about to die. So he got permission to go over and look after her, because no one else could look after her. And after a couple of weeks, she started to get better. And this monk ended up looking after his mum, caring for her for about 12, 13 years. She'd suddenly get sick and then, you know, he'd be there and then she'd get better again. His brother, you know, was a family man, you know, is look after the money side of things. And so opened up an account at the local grocery store. So the monk would actually go to the shopping for his mum. You know, didn't pay anything because on account, and they knew him, and wearing his robes, and he would cook a meal for his mum. And, you know, for himself as well. And then he always thought this was a temporary thing, another 2 or 3 weeks and mum would be dead. But she kept on going and going and going and going and going for 12 or 13 years. And eventually she died. And, you know, all the other monks, you know, thought, wow, what a wonderful sacrifice that was. And it also proved that, you know, that looking after your parents is really important. Even as a monk. I thought it was amazing. And he kept all his rules while he was there. Very kind monk. What about existing wealth, family ties and such? Does he need to choose the monastery and the precept, or is he being interviewed to be granted the permission to be a monk at a certain monastery? No, it's really up to them to find out where there's a good monastery, but be careful because the good monasteries is really difficult to get in. Because other people want to get in there as well. And one of the worst things was just visas. And these days, I don't know where the governments of our world are, that, you know, even though we don't, you know, monks don't take any money, they don't take any, they're usually really, you know, pretty good health, they don't tax the health system, and when they get old, they don't take a pension. It's always giving, giving, giving to the society all the time. So I don't know why they make it so hard to get visas for monks and nuns as well. Anyway, you mentioned about great teachers in the Thai forest tradition in Thailand. Do you have any recommendation of which teacher monastery to go to for a retreat where non-Thai speakers are welcome? maybe imagine Gunhas Monastery, they have many Westerners there, but also there's other monasteries as well, because these days that even a lot of Thais, they speak English. You know, so those boundaries between cultures, they're disappearing. I have a perpetual neck and back ache. But do I just observe the ache during meditation? Over time it will ease? Yeah, but you don't just observe the ache during meditation. You also take medication, do exercises, find out what the cause of the neck ache is. And so you don't just use meditation. You just, whatever can help you. Because sometimes people, meditation is what you should do, instead of going to see the doctor. Because sometimes the doctor comes and what is it? So remember this, when I first became a monk, I really had low energy. And I just wondered, I asked my senior monk, can you give me some teachings of meditation to increase my energy? And he said to me, eat more rice. So that's not meditation. He said, but I've been looking at you. You're not getting enough petrol in your car. No fuel. And so I was looking for something, a deep teaching. And it's something really obvious. You weren't sort of having enough food. So I increased my amount of rice and my energy came back. So sometimes you got sore neck. Now why is that? I don't know, maybe you've got a heavy, like many people have all these amulets. And they're just so heavy they make your neck sore. So look for the obvious first of all, before you go into sort of the meditation stuff. Ajahn Brahm, how do I take it further in my studies of the suttas? I've been reading Tanisarabhika's analysis of the Buddhist concept and his translation of the Pali suttas. My teacher regards him as a person who really researches thoroughly and examines the Pali canon. And I'm also thinking of getting Bhikkhu Bodhi's translation of the suttas. However, I do find that different teachers interpret the Dhamma and the suttas differently. How do I discern who's correct? One way of doing it is actually to develop deep meditation. And then you'll find out who is actually correct. And go and check out on the teachers. If they teach loving kindness meditation, you be kind. You must not be angry. There's a bit of hypocrisy there. So again, you can research in so many different ways. But one of those researches is through experience. I would like to understand how is chanting powerful, supposedly. Again, how that is powerful is when you when you practice your meditation, you can feel the mind has power, and then you can make use of it. When meditating this morning, I suddenly felt a wash of brightness and deep relaxation coming out of the meditation. I realized that there is true meaning why you have encouraged us to nurture goodness and kindness and courage and meaning in us. Doing so even when it was a struggle and was overwhelmed with emotion. Thank you, Ajahn, for always continue to inspire us and hope we will continue this journey with courage. Thank you. I deserve that. thank you for that. This morning, on a whim, I imagined myself experiencing a nimitta. As I imagined lights appearing inside my eyes, my breath became faint and I had a fun, peaceful time watching what images would appear. Is it okay to do so? Thank you. Yes, that's very good. You can use imagination. You can use visualization. What would an image feel like? And it works. How do we deal with people in higher position who abuse their authority to bully, abuse, exploit those who are more junior than them, such as superiors at work, higher-ranking officers in the military? I have seen people resisting by malingering, taking medical off, going on strike or retaliate by spoiling the work. okay, that if it's in the military, you know, people are only in the military in Singapore for a couple of years in a military service, and usually people who are just bullies, you know, they don't just bully you, they bully everybody under them, and as soon the word gets out, and those people just get into big trouble, because, you know, bullying is not part of the acceptable behavior these days. And you always find that bullying usually comes when there is people in power, either physical or given that power, and people not in power, without proper oversight. So, but if it's superiors at work, then that is more difficult, because, you know, you have to go to work for many more years than you're in the military. And again, that is a sort of a behavior which, you know, doesn't really work, because if you are a superior at work, you want people to actually to join in and to contribute. And shouting and ordering at people usually means that people, they don't give their very best. You ask the monks in over Bodhinyana Monastery, I never shout at them, I just encourage them, inspire them. And just bullying and shouting means they will behave when I'm around, when they think I'm watching, but when the boss is away, that's when the mice will play. And that's what happens when you have an authoritarian boss. So instead of that, you have a kind boss, and then people want to work for you. And they actually give you much more work. They actually contribute much more. They actually do that over time, because they like you. So the bullying is counterproductive. It's not modern business practice. It doesn't produce results in the long term. It's not sustainable. Thank you for your sermon. Thank you for serving us during this retreat with your teachings and jokes. This is my first time to Jhana Grove, and your teaching has inspired me to progress towards the path Nibbana. Yes, I do feel like the donkey, where not much has happened in the retreat, but I'll just chill and just enjoy. Also, thank you, Sister Eileen, for organizing this wonderful retreat. Is this your writing, Eileen? No, it's not. Very excellent. So we do have these retreats, and we do make progress little by little. There we go. Oops. Okay, here we go. Time to be quick. Brahma Wangso, I admire your conviction and courage in establishing the Bhikkhuni order at the expense of your friendship with the Wat Pa Phong Sangha. I admit I was shocked and initially critical of your stance, but now I totally support it. What I know, the Bhikkhuni order has been restored in Sri Lanka. The prominent Bhikkhuni was the late Ayakama, and that woman who once ordained as full-fledged Bhikkhunis went to Taiwan to ordain in Mahayana order. Are these nuns who ordained in Taiwan recognized as Bhikkhuni in Pali Buddhism? Exactly. They are recognized. Because the Bhikkhuni is the Bhikkhuni is the Bhikkhuni. So even a bhikkhu, a monk, you're a monk first, who then follows Mahayana, a monk who follows Vajrayana, a monk who follows Theravada, but you're a monk first. So you can actually switch traditions. You know, if I've had this quite often, that we have a lot of the Korean monks. Sometimes they come to stay at Bodhinyana Monastery, and so sometimes, okay, if you want to, you don't have to, you're welcome to wear your grey robes, but if you want to wear the brown robe, you can. You don't have to reordain, you're a monk. So you can wear that brown robe if you wish. If I went to Korea and spent a long time there, I'd wear one of the grey robes. You don't need to change your tradition. You're a bhikkhu first, a monk first. And in the old days, this was the travelers, the Chinese travelers who went to India. They found monks of so many different traditions and philosophies all staying in the same monastery, living together in peace and harmony. They may have different robes, but they were all monks. So the bhikkhunis are the same, the bhikkhunis are bhikkhunis. the legitimate. So in Taiwan, in Sri Lanka, in Australia, they are all bhikkhunis, sisters. And why is the Maitri's 10 preceptors order still insufficient compared to bhikkhuni? And it's one reason is that the bhikkhuni order is there. You might say, well, why does a person have to become a monk? And is it the Maitri's are the 8 preceptors. So, you know, the argument to that is, well, you know, if you can live 8 preceptors as Maitri's, the white-robed Maitri's in Thailand is good enough. Why don't you have just white-robed monks in Thailand? And the point is that there's many, many things which the white-robed nuns miss out on. In Sri Lanka, that they can't get a passport. They're not religious. The only people who can get a passport are the ones who are Samaneri and Bhikkhuni. They don't get any support by them from the government. The government only gives support to the bhikkhus. There's no very, and even going to the hospital. Mrs. Bhikkhuni Kusuma was telling me that she's actually, I think she's got a US passport, so, but many of the other bhikkhunis, if they go to the hospital, they said, no, you know, you're not a religious person, because the bhikkhunis aren't recognized. It's changing now, but, you know, it was really gross. So they couldn't get a passport to even leave the country to tour, because, you know, you're not a bhikkhuni, there's no bhikkhunis. So there's a lot of problems there. So why is the order insufficient? It's because there's so much stuff which they don't receive the equal respect and some of the privileges which, you know, a person who has got vows of poverty have. They expect you're only a Maitri, so you should have money. They say, no, I'm a bhikkhuni, I don't have money. He said, no, there's no bhikkhunis. So there's a problem there. And if you want to have the answer to that, it's best to ask them. They're far more articulate of the problems which they have. One of the reasons why I gave the ordination to the bhikkhunis here was because they requested it. I never initiated. I never went and said, hey, ladies, why didn't you become bhikkhunis? They came to me and said, you know, we want to become bhikkhunis. And there was no reason, in fact it's almost impossible for me to say no, to stop them. Because I know that if you stop a person doing a meritorious thing like becoming a bhikkhu, they're ordaining, that's my bad karma for preventing their legitimate and noble aspirations. Even one of our monks here, he got a lot of faith in the teachings and Bodhinyana Monastery, and so he wanted to become a monk. So I said, well, you know, you should get real permission from your mum first of all. His father, I think, was passed away, so he went back to Holland and asked his mum. His mum says, in your monastery, you know, do they give equal respect to women? Are there nuns under your teacher? And he said, yeah, my teacher, Ajahn Brahm, he got into big trouble, you know, for ordaining bhikkhunis. I said, really? Oh yeah, you can go there. Okay. Buddhism is about the cultivating of wisdom and compassion, a way of life leading to the end of suffering. But it may seem too lofty and deep for the man in the field. The man in the field? How many men are in the field these days? Tractors. The ordinary person needs something more simple, like a God or Savior. A religion like Buddhism that stresses on personal efforts may not be as appealing as a religion that teaches its followers to believe in a God and enjoy eternal bliss in heaven. That is once and done with. What is your view on this? By the way, Buddhism is the only religion that appeals to me. Sometimes just because it's easy, sounds easy, it doesn't really make it true. And so after a while, when it doesn't work, then that's when people just start thinking, well, maybe that's not working for me. The ordinary person likes things more simple. And they like to have an idea of a saviour. But then when they find, you know, it's not working for them, that they're not getting wealthy, their sicknesses aren't healing. And unfortunately for many of those religions, that, you know, there's things like child sex abuse, there's domestic violence. And some of those things are coming and cheating. And what was it? There was a prominent pastor in Singapore, and you know, he was basically fraudulently taking some of the money. And that just before his trial came up, or was it before he was about to go to jail, he was found fishing in the straits between Singapore and Malaysia. He wasn't escaping. He decided to go fishing. I think you know that one, don't you? Yeah, and so people lost a lot of faith in that. It's great if you have an example, someone you can look up to, but then, you know, they have to be the real thing. And when you find your leaders, you know, are not sort of walking the talk, then that makes you a bit upset. Anyway, don't want to criticize other religions. In essential desires by itself inherently unsatisfactory and suffering, or is it due to the clinging wanting that causes dukkha? No, sensory desires. The sensory desires are just never satisfying. They promise fulfillment, but in the end, they will always disappoint you. You have to have more. So you have a sensory desire, and then, you know, you finally get it, and then does that satisfy you? No, I want more, and more, and more, and more. So sensory desires. Your team wins the Premier League. Yay! But then they've got to win it next year as well, otherwise you get disappointed. So sometimes, you ever notice that people who win the lottery, as soon as they win the lottery, they buy a ticket next week. And it's well known, it's really crazy that you won the lottery, you got enough money. But no, they want more of that excitement. The sensory desires are always unsatisfying. You mentioned upon one having experienced all the jhanas, the five hindrances are superfluous for a very long time. Do you mean that after the fourth jhana is not the end all? No, it's not. Are you completely wise, free from hindrances and defilements permanently? Correct. It's not the end all. It's pretty powerful. It gives you a taste. Why do you use new water, as in Singapore, for the irrigation here? New water. For the irrigation here, we do have all of the water which goes in the septic systems, that does get irrigated for the plants here. So, I don't know what the question is, but I know the in Singapore they use some of the water and they purify it and they put it in bottles for you to drink. It's recycling or reincarnation of water, I don't know what. But anyway, it's just water. So, but we do use... Why do you use new waters in Singapore for the irrigation here? Even though that water is supposed to be bacteria-free, the health department, they're so paranoid about some bug being in that water, they won't allow you to use it. Just in case. Because then they get sued. It's a bit of a gross word, there is a strategy in many public servants in Australia called CARE. CARE. Please excuse the words. It doesn't stand for kindness. It means for cover, arse, retain employment. In other words, protect yourself so you can keep your job. Because they're paranoid about making a mistake, somebody getting in trouble and getting sued and losing your job. There's a lack of trust and courage. Okay, almost there. Three to go. Modern psychiatry says that mental health issues such as depression and schizophrenia are caused by asking too much questions and tiring your monk out so he gets very exhausted. No, I made it up. Modern psychiatry says that mental health issues such as depression, schizophrenia are caused by the brain releasing excessive hormones that triggers these abnormal behavior and psychiatric issues. Is that true from a Buddhist perspective? That begs the question, why does the brain release those hormones? You might notice release of hormones or excessive hormones and then have some of these conditions. But why does the brain sort of release those hormones? What triggers them? It could be stress, and stress caused not just by work, but just your attitude towards work. And that attitude towards work, thinking about pushing the wheelbarrows is the hard part. Doing it is easy. And you find that a lot of times that stress is because of basically unskillful, unhelpful mental attitudes. And that causes the hormones, the stress hormones excessively to be released. And that causes the problem. So it's not just hormonal, it's where do those hormones come from? Why are they released? And that is where that basically meditation, positive attitude, not fault finding, that can really help. By the way, a nun told me monks may also have dementia as they age, which is due to aging, not because they are lazy and naughty for not meditating, as some people misunderstand. Really? The cause of dementia, as I tell you, that people tell me the signs of it, is because you don't spend enough time thinking about the past, you don't plan for the future, and you're socially disengaged. No, dementia is something else. Sometimes a dementia is like a low energy of the mind, a boredom from the mind, exhaustion of the mind, of the brain. So that's where a lot of dementia comes from. What is the visa type that foreign monks, nuns use to practice long-term in Australia? I don't know. Because, you know, I'm a dual citizen. So Australia, British. We'd love to have a third one, so Singaporean. Can you get me a Singaporean one? Supposed to be, I was on the 30th, seeing the president, the honorary title. Maybe you can get one of those. And there was a nice story, there's a Thai monk living in Belgium. And the Thai monk, he never even asked for a Belgian passport, he had a visa. He was doing such good work, you know, for the Thai and other, for the Buddhist Thai and other communities over in Belgium. The Belgian government approached him and said, we'd like to offer you Belgian citizenship, a passport, as well as your Thai one, you know, because we value you so much. I thought it was so cool that where there's somebody really doing a good job, you don't have to apply and go through all this, you know, money stuff. You know, you're a wonderful asset to the country. Please, we'll give you a passport. I thought it was a really nice gesture. So foreign monks now used to practice long-term in Australia. I used to know this. They kept changing the goalposts. And even now, we're still struggling to fill all the requirements, you know, for visas here. Also, are lay people welcome to join range retreat with monks and nuns in Bodhinyana? A couple of people, but most lay people do the range retreat here. If yes, is there a limit to a number of lay retreatants allowed? Yes. How can we register for the next range retreat here? Is just go online, but it's already pretty full. So, you know, it's so very popular, so sometimes it's just so difficult to fit people in. That's unfortunately the case. And anyway, last one. Are the 12 factors of paticca samuppada dependent arising sequential and causal. They're all causal, but not really sequential, in the fact that when you say, like, vijnana, consciousness, causes nama-rupa, a nama-rupa that expresses the objects of consciousness, a nama-rupa causes the six sense bases, and six sense bases causes contact, and contact causes vedana. All of those things happen together. You can't have vijnana without nama-rupa, you can't have nama-rupa without vijnana, you can't have vijnana without the six sense bases, you can't have contact without the six sense bases, and without vijnana, without all the others, and you can't have vedana without those things. So sometimes it's like fire and the heat and the light. You know, these things all come together. So parts of it are sequential. This thing happens first and then it causes something else. But some of them, they happen all together. Which factor should we cease or obliterate to break the entire chain of suffering? A teacher says it's vedana, which I do not really agree. Yeah, I don't agree either. It's avijja, delusion. That is where you see the Dhamma, you understand what causes things, and once that delusion is broken, then dependent origination unravels. Not vedana, it's delusion. That is a problem. Because we're deluded. That's why we take, you know, what I said earlier, that lovely simile. That hurts, because your hand hurts, or your finger's broken. That's the reason why. Everything, oh, it's because of this, because of this. It's because of having a husband. It's because of my boss, you know, is a jerk. It's because, and unfortunately, money was taken away from me by my sister. Or it's because that, you know, that I've got this terrible sort of back problem. Because of, that's like, it's the wanting, the avijja, that causes things. Once the avijja is gone, nothing hurts. So, avijja is the problem. The delusion. Excellent. There we are. 9:34. Wow. Sadhu. 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 Very good. So thank you. And again, when there's lots of questions, and I do sometimes get tired, I'm getting old. So I try my very best, but, you know, if it wasn't to your satisfaction, well, that's life. Very good. Okay, very good. What happens tomorrow? What's the schedule for tomorrow? Just suppose we just do the usual, get up in the morning, have breakfast, and sitting up here, and 8 o'clock, Dhamma talk, and 9 o'clock, blessing, loving kindness. Metta, yeah, very good. Closing, okay, very good. So there'll be no interviews tomorrow.
No.
Excellent, great. Okay, so have a nice night's sleep.